dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's Monday. Let's raise a glass at the beginning of another week. It's time to unscrew, uncork, or saber a bottle, and let's begin exploring the wine glass. Today, we are traveling virtually to Italy thanks to a master class arranged by Napa Valley Wine Academy, America's premier wine school. Franciacorta is located in the Lombardy region of northern Italy, within the Brescia province. The region is nestled at the foothills of the Alps. Franciacorta refers not only to the name of the region, but the wine and the style of production. Franciacorta, like Champagne, makes this sparkling wine using traditional French method Champenois, or the classic method, with the second fermentation in the bottle. Join me as we dive into the very special region that produces exceptional sparkling wines, led by Peter Marks, Master of Wine, and Giammario Villa, Master Taster. Hey everybody, I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Sommelier Service, Champagne Specialist, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time to swipe, subscribe, rate, and review. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. I want to give a big shout out to SciUnity for leaving this 5-star review, a wonderful podcast. The intro fits perfectly with the energy brought by Lori and her guests. They keep the conversation going with laughs, relevant information, and great recommendations. Highly recommend to anyone who wants to see the human side of wine. Thank you, SciUnity, for leaving this review and for listening to the podcast. This truly is the best way to show support of the podcast and to help let other wine lovers find Exploring the Wine Glass.
Your host and head of education at the Napa Valley Wine Academy. The Napa Valley Wine Academy is thrilled to partner with the region of Franciacorta to present this deep dive into the history and terroir of Italy's premium sparkling wine. So with us today, we have two illustrious guests. We have Napa Valley Wine Academy's own Peter Marks, Master of Wine, one of only 54 American Master of Wines, and only the 10th American to pass the very, very difficult exam. And since passing, Peter Marks has been a guide and an inspiration to hundreds of Master of Wine candidates. So we're thrilled to have Peter Marks with us today. In addition, we have Giammario Villa, and he is the California ambassador to Franciacorta. He's a master taster, presenter, educator. He presents UCLA Extension, the Getty Museum, a long list of corporate clients that he presents for. So we're thrilled to have Giammario with us as well. So why don't we go ahead, Peter, would you like to say a few words before we dive in?
Sure. Thanks for the nice introduction, Catherine. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I hope you are as excited as I am to learn from Giammario, who is an expert in this topic of Franciacorta. This is a type of wine, sparkling wine, the top quality that you will find in Italy for the classic method. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when they think about sparkling wine, were automatically taken to Champagne as the, you know, the ideal climate and winemaking and quality, but there's some big rivalry coming from this really special region. And so without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Giammario because I can't wait to hear all that you have to say. I know I'm going to learn a lot from you and we'll have a great time. So Giammario, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to the Napa Valley Wine Academy. I'm thrilled to be here. And this is a wonderful day because when we talk about beautiful stories behind really charming and stellar wines, actually, it makes our day definitely better, and also our nights follow that. I'm happy to share with you a presentation. We're going to talk about history, styles of Franciacorta, an overview on the wine district, of course, a little bit of curiosities here and there, and then a tasting moment, and then we're going to have some questions from our wonderful audience today. I'm going to share my screen now in order for everybody to start, first of all, to look at this wonderful picture here. I want to jump straight in where we are. It's important when we taste a wine, unless we are facing a blind tasting, to acknowledge the area behind the glass, to acknowledge the traditions, to acknowledge also everything that comes around the vineyard. So starting from this photo, you can see a lake, which we're going to reveal in a moment, some mountains behind, a national park, some vineyards. So definitely a great environment, a great terroir also to grow our grapes here. Now, where we are, Italy is wide, actually it's long. Italy is not complicated from an enological point of view, but it's definitely complex for the wide offers of different wine districts, for the incredible amount of indigenous varietal, of course. We are far from the beauty of the Mediterranean weather, Mediterranean wines, highland wines, volcanic wines. We are right by the Alps. We are in the region of Lombardy. We are literally a shot away from Milan. And we are surrounded by some marvel of natures like the Rhaetian Alps to the north, the Lake of Iseo. Lake Iseo is maybe an underdog among the Lake of Como, Maggiore, or Garda, but is a gem that I invite also people to visit and experience directly what I'm explaining. The Oglio River, we need a water source like the lake, but also we need a river to give more complexity to the soil, is on the west side. We're talking of a very small area here overall, an area that is less than 200 square miles, 200 square kilometers, so 77 square miles. Very few cities nearby, actually villages, the next two major villages, Brescia, but most importantly, only 7,660 acres makes this wine region. Again, it's a gem, and already 62%, and probably as we speak a little more, are in organic certification already. So there is a sign of a strong care for Mother Nature, because people, locals, are the first appreciator, the first drinker of this wonderful wine.
Jamario, that figure is amazing to me, 62% organic. Can you think of any other wine growing region in the world that has such a high percentage of organic certified vineyards? Because I don't.
I don't. I might say maybe Willamette has his own certification. Mm. But I think Oregon has that kind of care compared to, because when you leave nature so deeply, it goes in its own. It's not marketing. It's really a lifestyle. It's really following the ethic of respect Mother Nature, not use any pests. But beyond that is to re-propose the tradition that past generation used to make and used to take on a way to respect Mother Nature, which is your goddess, literally.
Yeah. And does the region or the consortio have any goal to reach 100% by given time?
Well, eventually the goal is always to hit the round number, 100%. I believe that year after year, the number is growing. The consortio of Franciacorta, which I need to thank also for this presentation, and everything I'm saying, by the way, they have a fantastic website in English called franciacorta.net, where you can download a lot of information, pictures, and data and facts. They're monitoring not only the organic progress of the certification, but also the emission, the gas emission. So the impact of each winery on the local area. So the sustainability as a mentality comes even before the organic certification. And by sustainability, I mean wineries designed with the lowest impact on the surrounding area, reusing a lot of elements like the rasp, like the cut of the vines, the leaves, the grapes. So everything is reused. And it's typical also of smaller community that are more attached to their roots and their traditions.
Great. Thank you.
I would like to offer some more photos here because I believe on how evocative are these pictures, and also they put you in a set of mind. Seeing the Rhaetian Alps back can give you an idea of the weather. Of it's not only a question of high altitude, it's also the question of high latitude. We are close to the Swiss Alps, which are really, really close by. And the impact, the influence of the lake, we're going to see more deeply later, but the impact of the lake has that mitigation effect during the winter, releasing the heat from the water, as well as in the summer, cooling down the temperatures. As we all know, the grapes, the berry needs to suffer to produce good wine. So excursion of temperature day and night, winter and summer, winds, change of weather, those are all important elements. And I believe an area like this with lake and we're going to see the glacier effect, how important they are. This is another wonderful photo of a village nestled by the lake and the vineyards facing the lake, how green and lush everything is. And the importance of the history, of course, we're going to talk in a moment about tradition and history, because in this area, people make wine forever, since, you know, man's kind memory. And the castle is just on the church are just symbol of how tradition are strong still today, how people carry their memories and carry their know-how. The weather changes from summer, we go to fall, and then we go to winter. Don't forget, we are north of Milan, here by the Swiss Alps, and the snow, it's not uncommon. It's a very common element. And there is a charm. There is a charm behind seeing this landscape covered in snow. Everything is sleepy. Everything is ready eventually for the spring, for the blooming and the blossoming. But, you know, a very cold temperature compared to Italy speaking are not uncommon. And a few years ago in 2017, we've seen also 26 Fahrenheit around 5 o'clock in the morning, which is probably the time where the winemaker gets up to go visit his babies in the vineyard.
Hey, Jamario, it's 27 degrees in Napa this morning, so.
It's also the end of January, which makes sense. And that's why I like Napa. And that's why in Napa, winemakers can produce amazing wine, you know, just because of that diversity. I mentioned history. So I would like to give some elements about history because, first of all, let's start with the etymology of Franciacorta. It goes with Franche Curte or free courts. Free from what? From taxes. A very hot topic today, but also back in the days, the emperor decided to release from taxes the locals, and in particular, who? The monks. Yes, in the Roman times, they made wine, of course, in the even later. But with the arrival of two confraternity in particular, the Cistercian monks from all around Italy and the Clunia monks from Cluny, Burgundy, they revamp what was already a tradition, the production of wine. I won't go for religious or political topics, but you know how wine was a symbol of unity in a very dark moment of the opposite of unification, like the fall of the Roman Empire and the year 1000 and 1100 when things were rough. Okay, so the monastery represented that rebirth of the winemaking tradition, and they were also a very important business element where they were trading, selling, exporting. So being free of taxes, Corte Franche, was very important. And actually, the very first time that Franciacorta was mentioned in the annuals was in 1277 in the Nuova Brescia, the major municipality nearby. And then from then, we have a lot of written examples, but I'm going to just mention a few as I reported here in the presentation for simplicity, starting by an underdog, which we're going to talk more later, Herba Mat. Yes, this is an area where Chardonnay, Pinot Nero, and Pinot Bianco, I'm pronouncing on the Italian way because they are, if you wish, biotypes that change their DNA and their personality according to the soil and the terroir. But Herba Mat is a local grape that already in the 1567 was mentioned from a local agronomist, a local varietal. And shortly after, a whole number of records about the production of Erma Mate and other grapes, you know, like I mentioned Girolamo Conforti, because he was talking about mordacious wines already. Mordacious meaning lively sparkle, fizzy. So the tradition of Metodo Classico takes place already in centuries ago, like Girolamo Conforti witnessed. And we know that French people have a lot to say about winemaking, and the Napoleonic army wasn't exempted from that, the love of Napoleon for wine and so forth, not only actually, but we have in 1809 a beautiful record of the local land registry, which was recording already the amount of acres dedicated to the production of fizzy wines. Those are the words actually recorded. So over 2,400 acres already in the early 1800. Now, we need to jump back to the present, not to the future, but to the present, because we have a few landmarks, you know, to mention here also as a, to understand as a thank you to our production today. Franco Zigliani is definitely a pioneer. So the first Pinot of Franciacorta was released in the very early 60s. And from there, a wonderful waterfall of news happened. So the DOC appellation, so the regulation of the production according by the law, 1967. And then something I'm going to mention more in deep, and we can actually, I would love to interact with you about this, is the fundamental step that happened in 1992 all the way to 1995, which was the viticultural zonation study of Franciacorta, which was a study of what was in place, how many acres, what kind of grapes, who was making what. And the epilogue of this study is the 1995 DOCG appellation. And in Italy, this was the first and only DOCG strictly dedicated to the production of wine re-fermented in barrel, so Metodo Classico or Champenoise, if you want to call it.
And then, DiMario, I think, is it from 2003 then they'd been using the name Franciacorta on the label exclusively, just like you would see champagne, for example?
A few years after, yes, around early 2000, they used only the name Franciacorta in the label. And before that, in 2000, was founded the Franciacorta Strada del Vino, quindi a way to promote also the culture of Franciacorta, as we're going to see, with one name. And that's why they branded basically their wine. With one name, you name a wine district, a wine production, a wine style, just with one name. Do we want to see the behind the scene of the behind the scene? The behind the scene, I like to, when I talk about wine, I like to mention the three important factors or combination of factors that brings us to our wine. So number one is the climate, micro and microclimate, so the meteorology, understanding what happened. The seasons are fundamental to make good wine, the fluctuation, the change, the diversity. Geography and geology are also extremely important to understand the terroir, but also the soil, where is located the wine district, what kind of influence, always Mother Nature related. And then the last one is us, the mankind, the human factor, because here in the history and the culture, you understand eventually what people decided to be focused on, what style of wine worked better. And everything started with local tradition, local food pairing. You know, if you wonder why bold structure wine belong to a certain area, lighter wines to another, mineral forward and so forth, everything comes down also to local tradition, how the wine goes in the everyday drinking. And then today's, of course, is export and business and marketing. But these three facts are very important for me to explain. And if we want to also take one more look before we go more in depth on the soil concept of the Sebino Natural Reserve, it's just looking at this picture, first of all, I get nostalgic. Second, I get into the mood of understanding the complexity of the different elements that brings to the beauty of today. Beauty is complexity sometimes. Sometimes it's simplicity as well. But here, Mother Nature really put together a stellar amount of factors, again, from the Alps to the lake to the glacier. And, you know, this is an open conversation. Let's interact together. Peter, jump in anytime. But the concept of this morainic amphitheater. Look at the shape. So this is our wine region that we have two photos. One is the zonation of 1995. So the different soil and the different elements, we're going to see more in detail in a few seconds. Below you see the wineries and the landmarks of the Franciacorta tiny district. What happened 10,000 years ago? A glacier was moving from the north. And from the north, I mean a few miles away. The Alps are behind you, literally. And when the glacier arrived to Lake Iseo, split in two parts, creating this amphitheater shape that we can see. And the morainic soil, the mineral content coming from the glacier, was added on top of already very high mineral content of the soil. So mineral of the mineral. And here we have already the 101 for high quality viticulture, then connected to the very small size of the wine region, to the obsession for quality of the winemakers, we get to the, what is today Franciacorta. You see a lot of color, it's a mosaic. Let's try to give a little bit of explanation, and I will be happy to share with all our viewers and our subscribers also more in detail. This is a map you can find in the franciacorta.net website, by the way. But the different color represent the different kind of soil. And I wanna mention two, three kind of soil just to give an idea, because what is fantastic when you have a glass of wine, I don't want to make anybody jealous, but we're going to taste soon. And when you mention the floral aspect, the primary aromas related to the DNA of the grapes making the wine, where do they come from, right? So to give an example, if you look at the yellow color, which is the shallow morainic soil, mostly in the center where the glacier split, we have high complexity and very good content of sugar in general in the wine, and in particular, a spicy vegetal combination, spicy not coming from the use of oak, but natural in the characteristic in the DNA of the grape. So if you taste a monovarietal of a single vineyard, that will be a very helpful element to justify some descriptor. So I always invite people on turning the bottle, reading the label, looking, do some homeworks, you know, like look in the website, see the description. And another example is the dark red on the right side of the screen, more towards Brescia, a bit away from Lake of Iseo. And here we have a fantastic acidity. And not only that, high floral notes. So a winemaker sometimes is an alchemist. And it's always good to know what you want to get, the goal, right? So if you know the product you want to realize and you know where you come from, then the blending is a wonderful technique, the blending different vineyards or different grapes based again on the goal that you have. One more example, and then maybe Peter, you want to jump in, is the light orange, a bit more unusual around Franciacorta, but I like it very much because it's the most complex, but not most of the most persistent and explosive in the olfactory. Notes. So we're going to give some example of descriptor soon, and I like the geology. I'm a part-time geology aficionado because I believe that studying the soil, you can really connect the dots, justify the style of a wine, and also discover sometimes the sin of a wine, or discover what the winemaker couldn't achieve, or even better, achieve.
Yeah, so I always think of things in threes. It's sort of easy to remember. So when I think of Franciacorta, I always think of, as you mentioned, floral notes. I think of sort of dried fruit notes, and then that spicy vegetal notes. And as you depicted on this map, which is beautiful. And by the way, you mentioned the Franciacorta website. You can go and get that map and then all the descriptions of the different soil types. Yes. So would you say, is it true to, would it be fair to say that larger producers in the region might be blending from all of these soils and then having a very complex wine from that? And then perhaps the smaller ones are more, let's say, specified location that might give a more defined style of wine?
Normally speaking, I think so. We have to distinguish that there are very few large producers, as we know from a Californian perspective. Yeah. We still talk about small producer overall, like, with the exception of a couple. And they actually Even the smaller ones, they belong to a certain area. But doing my homeworks, I discover wineries even small owning plots in different part of the Franciacorta district. Just because, again, if you go back to the alchemy of making wine, they wanted to balance some characteristic or offer the chance to the wine to last longer or express a specific aromatic descriptor and so forth. Because it's a wonderful job making wine. It's even, I think, a better job tasting-wise and talk about wine. But going back to your question, normally, all the wineries, despite their size, own plots in different areas of Franciacorta. The larger production, if you want to think on a pyramid shape, have their top production probably belonging to a specific plot, a specific production to express the top of their tradition. But generally speaking, they come back to a blend.
Yeah. And actually, that reminds me of another interesting topic, I think, especially if we're thinking about which people will be most likely to do, comparing Franciacorta with Champagne. In Champagne, there are so many growers that are growing the grapes and making the wine, whereas in Franciacorta, the producers pretty much own most of their vineyard. So it's essentially all the state bottled wine when you're buying Franciacorta.
Absolutely, absolutely. You get that made in Italy twist. I was I had a beautiful Facebook Live with our your own Catherine, and we were talking about the tradition of Metodo Classico around Europe and around the world, and it's charming when you can detect that twist of Spanish style, French style, depending on the region, and same in Italy, and having the majority of the winemaker being grower and producer also kind of give you the stability on the quality of the production and also the perspective, a longer perspective. People don't think here in the short term. It's actually typical of a winemaker mentality, but a grower think a bit different. A grower and producer has a mentality set on the long period, which I find extremely fascinating because it's a different approach to life, to problems coming from Mother Nature and pleasures as well.
Good.
So before we offer a recap to our viewers, I just want to mention one more time how important is the word Franciacorta, because Franciacorta is in the market, might be not a common choice yet, and that's why we are here talking about it. Also because the mentality of the consumer, when in the wonderful days of the bars open and the restaurant open, waiting a friend at the bar and maybe having an appetizer and chit-chatting, what we want is not to order a champagne referring to a sparkling wine. We want to call the style we want. We want to call the production we want. So order a Franciacorta or something else, but know what you want. And when you order a Franciacorta, again, you order something that is a growing area, a production method, a wine style. It's something extremely easy to identify down to the beautiful land I'm talking about with you. And a land that comes with a bit of history, because again, DOCG back in 95, it's not particularly common, as is uncommon the idea of being so specific. We don't make, oh yes, we make a side of white wine for the, no. Franciacorta DOCG is strictly Metodo Classico. And that's the charm of the area. We mentioned the organic production earlier. Here you can see actually the numbers one more time. But I like, as I mentioned here in the slide, to connect the ethical growing and the quality coming from the organic. Sustainability is not something that you can just grab as a train and run for marketing reason. It's a commitment. It's a commitment that starts in your mentality. So here, the approaching, the ethical approaching to winemaking is in the heart first and then goes in the mind in order to justify and be thankful with what generations before you created and allow you today to produce also wine made organic. Most of the producers in the consortium are organic. By the way, there are pioneering sustainability respect to others, but we're talking about a very good average. Should we mention grapes? Do we want to? Yeah, should we go on?
Yeah, you can talk about the.
Yes. So the grapes that are allowed in Franciacorta are Chardonnay, Pinot Nero, Pinot Bianco, and Herba Mate. Going backwards, Herba Mate is very uncommon yet because only in 2020 vintage, we have now introduced by legislation the use of Herba Mate up to 10%. Also because we speak about very few acres. And if you make the math between the 80% of Chardonnay, the 15% of Pinot Nero, unexpected pretty low, and the 5% of Pinot Bianco, that makes almost, I mean, that makes 100%, but leaves very little room to Herba Mate. So I like how they reintroduced back in the legislation, and now they're taking care of the indigenous varietal to give an additional twist. Speaking of Herba Mate, I want to show you some characteristic of this grape, what to expect. Of course, 10% is not a lot to detect in the aromatics or in the style, but when you have a wine with a particularly strong acidity released from the 2020 vintage on, so expect the vintage coming, it's the Herba Mate talking, the strong acidity. It ripens very late, 1 month later than the average Chardonnay and Pinot Nero. It's not salted, the finish is sapid. Salt is a defect, sapid is a characteristic. The very herbaceousness and the 62 acres were just 60, I think, a few months ago, so they're trying to plant more Herba Mate, are a small number, but a very important symbolic, you know, element to go even more towards the indigenous or the respect for the local varietals.
Yeah, and it's a good hedge against global warming. Being a late ripening and high acid grape, it will play well into that, perhaps allowing for those conditions if they do come.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, why don't they allow it for the Sauternes?
Because the Sauternes, which we're going to talk in a moment, it's not only a Blanc de Blanc, and Herba Mate is a white varietal, but also is a wine always characterized by a very creamy texture. Smooth entrance. They say it's creamy at sight and even creamier at taste. So the Herba Mate will dry off the direction the Sauternes has, adding too much acidity and taking away that creaminess, that rich texture typical of Sauternes that you expect from Sauternes.
Yeah.
Now we're going to the harvest and pressing, and then a few words about the production of Metodo Classico before we talk about the styles. You know, this is something actually everybody knows. It's just a quick recap. So the grapes are picked up, everything is manual. It's about between the first decade of August to the very first of September, normally, climate change, early shifts every year. Now, the free-run juice most of the time then creates the base of the wine. At spring times, when the temperature in the cellar and out of the cellar is at the right spot, help forming the cuvée. And here, actually, I would like for you to jump in and using your WSET, maybe language recap briefly the few steps that brings the wine to the actual Metodo Classico.
Yeah, sure. I just want to make a quick mention of the yields on that previous slide. You know, the yields, I have it in hectoliters per hectare. It's 65 hectoliters per hectare that's allowed. And yeah. In Champagne, they allow 79 hectoliters per hectare. And sometimes with an agreement of the CIVC, they can go up to a little bit more than that. So it's pretty amazing the lower yields that you find in this region.
And that's the top you can reach. Doesn't mean that every winemaker hit that top number. Most of the wines we were tasting today in general in the market are way lower than that.
And now a word from our sponsor. Dracena Wines loves to give back. There are so many fur babies that deserve to find their forever home. We would love to be able to help as many as possible. If you are part of a nonprofit organization or know of a nonprofit organization that would like to hold a fundraiser, please contact us at contact@dracenawines.com or visit our website, dracenawines.com, to fill out the form. How does the fundraiser work? It is super simple and costs your group absolutely nothing. Together, we will choose a month that your group will be sponsored. During the month, you promote the fundraiser just like any other event you'd hold. At the end of the month, we will donate 20% of the sales to your organization. The donations will be made in the name of each individual who purchased the wine so that you know exactly who helped the animals. Our goal is to raise as much funds as we possibly can and to help as many animals as possible. So please help us help as many fur babies as we possibly can.
So as far as I think most of you are familiar with the traditional method. The tirage is the base cuvée, adding the sugar and yeast to start the second fermentation. The maturation, which takes place in the cellar, and unusual for their regular brut, it is 18 months minimum, which again, if you're in other parts of Europe, in Cremant and Champagne, it's 15 months. So you're growing a little bit extra beyond the norms that you find in France. And of course, riddling. I noticed in the picture you've got the hand riddling, but are they using a lot of the Giro pellets in Franciacorta? Would you find that to be the case?
Some winemakers that makes significant numbers, and especially the brut typology that goes in the market as a flagship of the winery, yes. But the manual element that often is a marketing picture shown in presentation is actually part of the actual reality of this produce. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, given the number of small producers, that it's more likely they're doing it by hand, as you see in the picture.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then again, the disgorgement, removal of the yeast, adding the Cours d'Expedition, the little bit of wine to fill up the volume that may have been lost through disgorgement. And you can see the different styles of sugar levels. Interestingly, I think with Franciacorta, generally you see the range for Brut from 0 to 12, but I think you'll find most Bruts are in that 6 grams or even less. They tend to be not adding as much sugar as perhaps more northern climes. And you can see that more likely quite a bit of the Brut Natures or the Dosaggio Zero, which are the equivalent of 3 grams or less.
You're correct. I had a hard job to taste and receive a lot of samples. And I noticed a lot of extra Brut coming from Franciacorta. And in the sugar level of the Bruts, I noticed, like you mentioned, between 4 and 5, 4 and 6, the average in general. Yes. Should we talk about the flavor categories at this point?
Yeah, let's go right ahead, please.
Let's go right ahead and give some room to question and tasting then. Okay, right. Franciacorta, when you find a Franciacorta, it's normally a blend of Chardonnay, Pinot Nero, Pinot Bianco up to 50%, and from now on, Herbamat up to 10%. As you mentioned, 18 months from the tirage. And as far as style, we have a wide range of styles, dosaggio zero, which means, no sugar added at the tirage, extra brut, brut, extra dry, all the way. We have the chance of sec and demi-sec. It's not really anymore a common choice. So we know that we prefer to eat the calories at this point and drink less calories. I want to spend a moment more on Sauternes because it's a wonderful story. Even if it comes from, the 80s and the 90s, it's not really popular. So let's talk about this. I notice a lot of people interested on Sauternes. I have a Sauternes in the glass here I'm going to show you quickly. But the story starts in the 80s. And a small group of winemakers were looking to create a new style of Franciacorta. They were playing around. They were using only white varietals. They were saying, let's use a slower and lower barrel fermentation. But nothing was set by law. It was just a spontaneous, pioneeristic exercise of some winemakers. And then they came out with a word, Satinato, Sauternes. In the early 90s. And the etymology is just a combination of the satinato, the frosted glass, but also the silk, seta. Silk as the creamy texture, the soft texture, the charming, smooth, warm hug that a glass of Sauternes offers you. And at that point, in the mid-90s, when the zonation was ending, a panel of tasters, producers, journalists got together and went through 184 samples, and they decided to decode finally and say, okay, what are the steps before the wine making? What kind of style are we want? Deciding the identity of a wine is an extremely important factor when you come down to decoding. It's not only allowing the grape or that sugar level, it's also giving direction of the identity and the profile that the wine should offer to tell that the wine is characteristic of that area, as well, of course, physical, chemical, and organoleptic characteristic. Now, when they decoded what Sauternes is, they decided to offer, first of all, only Blanc de Blanc, excluding Herba Mat, already present, but saying Pinot Bianco no more than 50%. I noticed some producers using Blanc de Blanc in the label still today. And why so, I ask myself? Because the barrel pressure, because the sugar level. So in Sauternes, you cannot have more than 5 atmosphere in the barrel, while in the other production goes, you know, up to 6. Very important element for that texture we're looking for. Only Brut is Sauternes, so only up to 12 grams per liter. So it excludes other form of production. That's the way they write still Blanc de Blanc. And the aging is minimum 24 versus the 18 that I showed before. You can make a Sauternes millesimato, a vintage Sauternes, spelling the vintage in the front label with 85% at least of the grapes from that vintage, 30 months, and a Riserva Sauternes, 60 months. Matter of fact, we have other form of production here, rosé. And when we talk about rosé, I want to give you just a quick peek, okay? Just to create some expectation, there are different ways to leave the rosé. The color of the rosé, it's not always the same. The intensity and the fragrance will change. So rosé, of course, requires Pinot Nero as a backbone and is minimum 35% and Chardonnay maximum 65%. What important to mention, the aging, 24 months minimum. A lot of these producers go up to 30, 36 and more. So there is extra love. I like the Spanish twist, by the way. The wine goes out when it's ready to drink. And in Franciacorta, the wine goes out when it's ready to drink as well. So the aging is really relative. Quickly, the vintage and then the Riserva follow the same rules I just mentioned. So 30 months from the tirage and 60 months minimum, with the exception of Sauternes, of course, because the atmosphere and the grapes allow. So these are the styles of Franciacorta you can find in the market. I just show a couple of photos about food. What do you think? What should we go for now?
Yeah, let's do some quick food photos. And then I know we have a number of questions that we can ask Catherine. We'll go right to those as soon as we can.
Yes. Okay. Excellent. So very briefly, food and wine is like love. You know, when a couple get together, when the two important, the yin and the yang, comes to the same table here. So, and let's think broad. When we end up briefing the very first printing in Franciacorta, very long path to get this job with them, they said, well, let's say that Franciacorta is not a wine that you want to open just to celebrate something, or it's not a wine you want to drink only for appetizer and aperitivo. And it's true, because look at a risotto mantecato with grana padano. They don't use Parmigiano Reggiano. It's more about grana due to the geography, okay? But that creaminess is probably a good idea to pair with a Sauternes. You offer creamy texture in both sides and a good acidity to get ready for another sample. La Tinca al Forno. Tinca is a lake fish. Strong flavors, high fat. So when you get a little, you know, could be grilled, so a little burn in the skin, or bake in a terracotta container like this one, I think rosé is a wonderful pairing in order to add some body and some structure and also some extra flavor to the pairing. And of course, salame could be from anywhere, but it's a great brut pairing just because the acidity, the tiny persistent and long chain of bubbles can clean up and rinse your palate. Let's think out of the box dessert. Okay, some residual sugar, Blanc de Blanc or again a Sauternes can be a good pairing. Or you don't need to go for the pairing by concordance, can be discordant. So a Brut again to work out the dessert. Wonderful plate like the Corrigone Pane Sale. Don't just drink the Sauternes at the bar or waiting for a friend. Open a bottle and enjoy with your food. There with the pairing. I tried a lamb shank with a vintage dosaggio zero, and it was a wonderful challenge.
Great. Well, thank you, Jamara. I'm seeing quite a few questions that have come in. I haven't actually had a chance to look at them. So let's turn it over to Catherine to see what questions that we'd like to have answered.
Great. Thank you. Thank you to both of you. We do have a number of questions, so I'll pose a few of them here. One of them, what allows for the high percentage of organic vineyards? Is it producer commitment?
It's a long path. It's a long path, as you know, that that is, takes several years. And it's the producer mentality. First of all, like as I mentioned, the sustainability is a daily habit even before the organic concept came out. Organic is a certification. It needs to go with some parameters. And keep in mind that, you know, not maybe today, but back in the days, maybe your neighbor was not organic, you were organic. So there was some confusion on the quality of the organic certification. So having a mentality behind the scene helps on the strong commitment, and also having a community that agrees on that, very important. It's not only the work of one winemaker, pioneer that goes in his way that one day will teach to others. It's a community group in a consortium that act harmoniously because they're aware of the small size of the district. They're also aware of the fantastic quality they make. So this unity and the commitment and the mentality behind all together bring it to this stellar number that we see today.
Great.
And also most of the rain falls in the fall and winter. So, you know, there's good climatic conditions to allow for that.
The weather on your side, normally speaking, it's always a good thing.
So it sounds like it's a great combination of producer commitment and climatic conditions. That's great. Let's see. With most of the producers being growers, the producers must be able to show nuances in aromas and flavors and styles due to the majority of estate wines. Can you comment?
Can you rephrase it?
Yeah, sure. Just a question about just the wonderful, you know, with the producers being growers, you must, because they're having, because they're essentially estate wines, that must lead to some great expression, you know, different expressions, you know, of the wines of Franciacorta.
Absolutely. Let's say if the bottle is the expression from a specific vineyard, this is even more true. But if you think about the idea of either combining different plots from the same vineyard, also combining plots from different areas, then it comes down again to what you want to express. And of course, the fragrance is typical of any Metodo Classico, right? So when you look for that crust bread, when you look at that brioche aromas, but the step further, again, is the primary aromas. I might like a hint of oak here and there, even in sparkling wines, but I'm sorry to use this comparison with makeup, but makeup can enrich the beauty, but also can cover what is a beautiful, simple beauty. So the use of the correction in the wine in the cellar is not very common here. They like to express the primary aroma, so that floral notes, that almonds, that acacia flower, that citrus blossom. Those are, don't forget that this lakes area express amazing citrus fruits, from origins to lemons. So, and you find those elements also in the descriptors. There are a wonderful relation between what you see with your eyes and what you smell with your nose.
Beautifully said, beautifully said. Let's take one more question I'm going to ask, because then, you know, the discussion, let's then have a discussion about a few of the key styles of Franciacorta. So the next question, how does the Franciacorta region, the size, compare to the Champagne region of France? So a size comparison, if we use maybe square kilometers. Or any...
Well, it's unfair to compare. The size is really, really minimal compared. So if you can see here, from this picture, first of all, let's think about the proportion in your own country, okay? Because it's important to compare to the neighbors and to the production in general around Italy, speaking of Franciacorta. You see on the top left, Lombardy region compared to the size of Italy. In the bottom left, the size of the Franciacorta district around the Lake of Iseo, and then all the plots in the right-hand picture. So maybe Peter, we remember better than me the size of Champagne, but we're talking about the difference between a village and almost a metropolis with the sub areas of Franciacorta, which we have are uncomparable to the size of the sub areas of Champagne. Absolutely. And it gives another idea of the micro perspective of this production, not only on size, but also on characteristics. Mm-hmm. Village versus metropolis.
Okay, great. So I think we should jump into, you know, for anybody who has wines in front of them, if anybody, you know, would like to, you know, even if you don't have wines in front of you, we're going to be discussing styles of Franciacorta wine. So please, Peter, Gemario.
Yeah, so we have three of the styles that are have been discussed. We have a Brut, non-vintage Brut. We have the Satin, and then we have a Rosé. So we'll start off with the Brut.
Yes, let's start with the Brut. Salute a tutti. I'm going to start, and then please, Peter, give your contribution. But immediately, the yeast are important, of course. The yeast are the justification of the style of the wine. The selection of the yeast that are normally local yeast are the majority of what the wine will be, from the characteristic of the descriptors all the way to the size of the bubbles, the persistence, and so forth. So the yeast are important. You can detect the yeast in terms of that brioche, that cream immediately. But also, when I get this this combination of citrus and tropical fruits together, it gives the dichotomy of a wine already, and also the perspective, something that will evolve, something that will change, therefore something I can appreciate today or in a few years from now. It is almost like a gingery note also that maybe goes on the tropical.
I'm going back again to what I said earlier, floral citrus. There's some beautiful sort of tree fruit, apple, pear, a little, you mentioned the slightly riper fruit. And then there's that spice. The beauty of the wine that I have, at least, is showing the, you get the elements of the fruit that is, I think, perfectly integrated with the autolytic notes. I mean, the autolytic notes are not dominating the fruit. Mm-hmm. They're juxtaposition just perfectly together.
If my other note on this, I ask myself, actually, last night I was thinking about Franciacorta. It takes me all the way to Morfeo arms. I was thinking, well, where the morainic soil, where the minerality comes to this game? Because when you're tasting a volcanic wine or island wines, you have, you know, like that flinty aromas or wet rocks or salmaster, seaside iodine. But here, where is the minerality expressed? Is in the taste, the sapidity in the finish is the element you can connect to the minerality. Because like we said, it's hard to find the flinty or wet rocks or descriptor like that on the aromatics of a sparkling wine, of a Metodo Classico. And I like to say sapid again, because salt is a defect of a wine, while sapid is a characteristic, and it gives me that breeze, cold breeze coming down the Rhaetian Alps all the way to the vineyard.
Yeah, and so much elegance too. The wine that I have is 80% Chardonnay and 20% Pinot Nero, and there's just a little bit of structure from the Pinot, but the Chardonnay fruit is just so elegant and fresh. So much finesse to the wine. I was just looking at the tech sheet that I have, and you know the acidity is really nicely integrated, and that finish is so dry. And I looked, and it's 3 grams on the tech sheet, and it's just. That to me, just as we talked about earlier, you can make really exceptionally well-balanced wines and not have so much dosage, or as you like to say, fewer calories, right?
I'm a foodie, as you are probably, yeah. And we need to make some choices at some point in life, okay? And again, the closer to zero, the better for me, but I don't want to close the doors to any production. Exactly. Since we have about 10 minutes left, I would like to go to the second samples, which is, by the way, I poured this wine definitely 1 hour ago. And seeing this chain of bubbles still going so small, I know we don't spend too much time in bubbles in WSET, but this is definitely an indicator of class. And now what we want is, In case of Satin, heading to a riper style in terms of fruits. A riper style without closing the door to life, to acidity, absolutely. These are wines you can definitely age. I know it's not fashionable to age a Metodo Classico or a Champenoise, but some of you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And this floral note is coming out, and the most significant descriptor for me is definitely that dry fruit, that almond note. That macadamia almond that goes with the Satin. And when it comes to Satin, I get even more thirsty because I do want to receive that warm hug of the creamy texture.
Yeah, I was wondering, Jamaro, if you could maybe stop sharing your screen so we could see you a little better holding up the glass. Yes.
Let's do that. Here we go.
There you are. Perfect.
Yeah. Me and my friend Turando. Yes, so the texture is different. Of course, the acidity comes later. The acidity is a progression, a slower progression. So first you have that perception of creaminess, of smoothness, and then the acidity starts kicking in and rinsing your palate, and then the sapidity, the hint, and the finish, and then comes back, if you exhale from your nose, on the retronasal aromas, that herbaceous element and that nice almond combined together. I don't want to go too specific because I want to give the descriptor that belong to Satin as a category. So we want to mention the creaminess at sight, the way the wine runs into the glass, the creaminess at texture, but let's not forget we're not eating a pastry. We need to have that vibrant acidity that is the element for the food pairing and the element for a longer life of the wine.
Yeah, and you mentioned the creaminess. Obviously, that's apparent on the palate, but I even get a little bit of that in the nose as well. Beautiful. You know, going from the Brut to the Satin, it's sort of like going from a nice soft cotton to a silk. There's just that beautiful, seamless texture.
In the better days, I used to open my front door, walk around the block, and get to the first bar. And by bar in Italy, you mean a pastry bar where you have your cappuccino, your baked goods, and so forth. And they have also super alcohol, by the way. And order a brioche with apricot made by them, okay, manually. Everything was made by hand. And that scent, and I believe when you study to become a somm and a certified somm and so forth, nobody is born with a talent, or very few, okay? The most important job for you is to connect the dots, and the dots are your memories. So remember a taste, remember a flavor, because it will help marking in your mind like the characteristic of a wine. It will be easier to remember, it's easy to describe, and will become a form of love, of course, you know, talking about wine and facing wine. So for me, it's a Madeleine, but instead of a Madeleine, it's a brioche with an apricot jam inside.
There you go. It's almost lunchtime here. You're killing me.
It's almost lunchtime. I know. Well, speaking of that, I was talking about that grilled lake fish or even a grilled sardine talking about. And then when I poured myself the first rosé, I told myself, why don't I pour also a second rosé, right? So we can see.
Those are two rosés right there?
These are two rosés. Wow. Again, we want to talk about the wineries, not the winemakers, but we will talk about the winemakers if you guys email me. Or follow up, and you eat with your eyes, and you drink with your eyes as well. Sometimes you start at least, and from this color, you can already exclude some descriptors. From this color, you can exclude some direction the wine is taking, and also some ideas of food pairing. Now, of course, we want to taste the wine in order to double check the facts. But when you have this wild strawberry, when you have this gentle wild berries. Together with stone fruits, it's like a young peach, like a young nectarine peach. And then you go to the second glass, and that boldness in the color comes out also in the boldness of the descriptors, I am assuming, or more Pinot Noir in the blend, of course, perhaps a little maceration longer and so forth. But then the raspberry comes out.
A strawberry.
Yes, it's really charming how the rosé takes different routes. So if a grilled fish is this glass for me, a grilled bluefish perhaps, or a baked bluefish perhaps, here I can think about of a seafood appetizer or even a gratin mussel, something I adore. So you have your mussel and you add some breadcrumbs and parsley and garlic and you bake in the oven and you have this simple dish with a few ingredients that goes with apparently the simple color that instead opens up a huge world of stories.
I'm curious, do you know how much Pinot Nero is in that one that you have in your hand?
This one has, I believe, 15-20% here.
Okay.
All the way to 35%.
Because one I have is 60% Pinot.
Okay. Yeah, the maceration, the skin contact will justify the intensity of the color, even more of the blend per se, of course, because at that point the skin will release longer, you know, more tonality and so forth. I see.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in Franciacorta, to make the rosé, you can either do a bleeding of the juice from the skins, or you can add red wine to make it rosé. Is that correct?
Not the Pinot Noir, the only red variety allowed, or bleeding, yes.
Yeah, okay.
They actually use
some... I see Catherine's back here.
I cannot mention the name of the producer, but I've seen machine coming from Champagne following that technique. But it's a collaboration of pleasures.
Oh my goodness, we could talk all day about Franciacorta, and especially with Peter Marks on hand and Jamario coming in with his just eloquent, you know, descriptions. So wonderful. Just a
we could drink all day too, Catherine.
Yeah, exactly.
We just got started,
exactly. You want to come back in a few hours with Peter and mine.
Let's speed up for sure. But let me ask there's a number of questions have come in, and let me just try to cover at least a couple of them. There is interest in the glass that you're holding.
Yes.
People are wondering, you know, what is the better glass to taste the Franciacorta in? Can you speak to that glass shape, please?
The tulip shape, in my opinion, that's why also it's branded Franciacorta design for Franciacorta, because normally I will taste everything on a wine tasting glass for white wine. And for sparkling wines, for Metodo Classico, yes, it is beautiful to see the bubbles running up to the top and the flute, but you do not open the flavors. You need still to be able to have the shape help the molecules of the wine coming up, breaking, and coming to your nose. So having a flute will limit the capacity of expression. Having a wider glass will have a faster action on expressing the scent of the wine, and then shorten up the experience. So the right combination is the tulip glass that we might be able to gift to some of our viewers at some point. But this is, and also the quality of the glass, of course, the crystal makes a big difference on the way the wine runs into the glass and brings up the flavor.
Yeah, I was just gonna add, I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's a nice aromatic fruit quality, and then you also get the autolytic. So having a wider rim is going to help recognize some of that fruit to be able to really appreciate the generosity of fruit that Franciacorta offers. And also a glass like this will not hide any flaws, or will, you know, whereas a flute might be more likely to hide flaws. So this is a quality driven region, as we've talked about. So you don't have to worry about that.
I'm going to make a commitment here. When the God of Wines will allow us again to have a class in the class and teach, when it's time for Franciacorta, your students will have our glass to taste the wine.
Excellent.
I think we'll sell out fast.
It's recorded, so I can't go back.
I love it. You know, Peter, you mentioned the autolytic character. We do have a question about what is the difference that you'll find between Prosecco and a Franciacorta wine?
Yeah, well, Prosecco is made in the tank or Chermont method. So those wines are meant to accentuate the fruit and not really have any yeast quality because there's very little time on the dead yeast cells. So really, they're two divergent styles, fruit-based for the Prosecco, whereas with Franciacorta, you have that beautiful integration, not only of fruit, but the brioche, the toast, the biscuity character that makes it evenly more complex and evenly desirable in a different entire style of winemaking.
Absolutely. If I may add one word about this, you know, of course there are stellar producers on one side and not the other side, not to generalize, but Franciacorta, if before the comparison was village to metropolis, now is village to region, to macro area, because Prosecco comes from two regions, literally Veneto and Friuli, very wide. okay, surface. So it's very hard to control, you know, what's happening in the bottle. Here, every bottle, the importance of the second fermentation in the bottle, which is the essential difference between a Charmat Prosecco and also Franciacorta, is the story of the yeast. Every bottle is a story apart because every bottle experiences its own catharsis of the yeast, and therefore a whole different book to read.
I love it. Both of those explanations are fantastic. Okay, one more. And we have so many questions, but one more today before we sign off. Are there vintage Franciacorta and any outstanding vintages?
Yes, there are. First of all, we come from a few vintages, 11, Stella, 12, 15, and 16, very good vintages. In the franciacorta.net website, you will have the vintage section with the whole story from the 1970, I believe, all the way to today. So in that section, you will see vintage by vintage, what happened and what happened. I want to mention, if you're lucky to find 95, 97, 2005, are stellar vintages. Catherine and I shared a beautiful bottle of a vintage Franciacorta Dosaggio Zero around that area. 84, 88, and 90 are really remarkable.
You'll bring all those to class, right, Jamario?
Sorry?
You'll bring all of those to class?
I will bring, that means there is a class coming. So yes, yes, it's wonderful to walk in a shop and go in the vintage section. And I love back vintages for regular wine, quote unquote, for Franciacorta is the same. The beauty is expressed in different steps. The evolution of the wine in the bottle is as charming as its story. So a wine today will tell a different story. The difference between a book and a wine. You can reinterpret the book, but the book is written in the same way. While the wine changes the pages, changes the story. So year after year, you will see a different story. Even the plot is the same, okay?
Eloquent as always. Okay, Jamario, a lot of people want to know where they can find these wines. Should they be, can you just tell us, you know, before we sign off, are you... You want people to email you? How would you like to help people find you?
Yes, in the final slide, I offer my email, which is Jamario with two M's at ucla.edu, my email. You can find me on the social media. Name and last name, Jamario, at Jamario Villa. And I can give you more specific suggestions based on where you're from. But normally speaking, you know, your boutique local shop, where you have a very valid buyer, should be able to help you. I don't want to mention the major chains, because in the major chains or the major shop, of course they have Franciacorta, because they tend to cover all the productions, okay? So you walk in a major shop and you will find a Franciacorta. But if you want to find a specific twist of Franciacorta, go to the local boutique shop, support your local business, talk to your local wine helper, tell the preferences, tell why, and don't buy one bottle to celebrate something special. Buy a case. Keep aside a few bottles, enjoy more often a pleasure, because we deserve, especially these days, we deserve to treat ourselves better and our loved ones.
I love it. Jamario, I'm getting in my car right after this webinar.
And with that, I do want see you to in 8 hours.
I love it. I do want to thank you both. Thank you so much, Peter Marks. Thank you so much, Jamario Villa, for this excellent presentation. So thank you again to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I am also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoybutt. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe to help others find me more easily. And most importantly, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Music is Wine by Kevens. Until next week, Sláinte.
There is always time.